Hello, and welcome to Cage Club. Two fans, 74 movies, one cage. This is episode 32, Snake Eyes from 1998. I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Joey Lewandowski, and this movie starts out amazingly, incredibly, and then unfortunately dives down from that amazing opening 13-minute tracking shot.
Yeah, this beautifully unexpected tracking shot at the opening of this film is phenomenal. I was just flabbergasted watching this. I mean, it's got all the hallmarks of a great shot like this. Like, you don't even realize it hasn't cut for, like, the first 5 minutes, and then you're like, oh my god, this shot hasn't cut.
What's kind of weird is that when we watch these movies, you know, I take notes, I know you take notes, and so I'm looking up and I'm looking down, and I realize, like, a couple minutes in, I'm like, I don't think they've cut yet, because, like, you see Cage in the beginning walking on the phone, and I know that they're sort of doing, like, a walk and talk, but I sort of assumed it would be kind of, like, Sorkin-y, like, walking down the hallway on the phone, but then I'm like, I don't know if they've cut yet, so I had to rewind it to the beginning, and I watched it again. I mean, there are supposedly cheats, you know, there are places online that you can find out where the cuts are, but for the most part, I mean, it's a pretty good-looking 13-minute tracking shot to start this movie, and, like, what's awesome about it is that we had these three amazing action movies that on the last episode, City of Angels, we talked about how it was kind of like a come-down. It's not bad, but it's not what we were hoping for. And this, like, the 13 minutes, it's like, all right, we're back in it. Like, this is Cage Club. This is what Cage Club's all about. This 13 minutes is just sort of like, it's just so exciting.
Yeah, first thing I noticed when Cage is on screen is he's back with this high energy, high intensity, full-on confidence in his character. He was almost mute in City of Angels, you know. He just did a lot of face acting, kind of. This is, like, what I noticed is, like, yeah, he's here to play. We're going to get a great performance from him. Brian De Palma's directing this film. So I'm sort of expecting it to look really good and have a lot of tricky sort of photography going on. That's one of his trademarks. And it's all happening right here at the start, you know, this great tracking shot, this great performance, and all this energy, and I'm on board for this ride.
And it's not even just the directorial stuff that really gets us amped up. It's like the whole plot and setting and everything. We're in Atlantic City, you know, the Vegas of the East Coast. It's a new spot for Cage, but it's sort of similar to what he's been used to. There's a massive, don't call it a hurricane, tropical storm Jezebel outside. It's raining, there's, like, thunder all throughout the movie. They're at this boxing match between, like, the champ and this young upstart contender. The building is about to be demolished, like, this is the last event. Like, there's all these different elements coming together, and it's all captured in this 13-minute opening shot that between just the energy of, like, what's going on and the way that De Palma shoots it, it's just so exciting and exhilarating, considering how, like, little action there is. I mean, there's things happening, but in terms of just, it's mostly, like, camera action. Like, this might be, like, the most exciting 10 minutes of Cage Club yet. It's awesome.
Yeah, De Palma's really good at, I guess, like you said, like, making mundane things exciting with the way he's shooting it. You know, I agree. It feels like an action film, but the only action taking place is a guy walking down a hallway, walking down another hallway, that kind of stuff. But yeah, it's intense. It's just got that energy behind it. And what I also love about this opening is, like you said, they're establishing all these things, and we get a lot about Nick Cage's character right here in these moments, right?
Like, yeah.
He's dressed in gold. He's got, like, a gold suit, a gold shirt, a gold cell phone. At first, I thought maybe he was a bookie or a pimp or something, but it's revealed that he's a detective that grew up in Atlantic City.
Yeah, not only is he a detective, he's sort of like a crooked detective, a little bit of Shades of Bad Lieutenant coming. He's walking down an escalator, right, or he sort of walks into a place where he's not supposed to be, and he pulls out a badge. And I was wondering, like, is he a cop? Like, is he actually a cop, or is that a fake badge, and he's just some kind of con artist? And then you see him shake down Luis Guzman and get, like, those $3,000 and stuff? I'm still not sure. And eventually, as the movie goes on, he becomes this cop who is willing to take a bribe, but also sort of seems to have, like, a complicated sense of morals. It's kind of like the most honest crooked cop that I've ever seen in a movie.
Yeah, he's got, like, strange ethical boundaries, sort of not unlike Batman, right? Like, we come to learn, like, just, like, he won't kill, he's never killed anybody. Like, that's just a line he won't cross, you know, that's point of no return for this guy. He presents himself as a celebrity. He's this hotshot AC detective who walks his beat with an attitude. Everybody knows him, he knows everybody, and he's just feeling the charge of the crowd tonight, and it's fight night, you know, and it's sort of like the end of an era in Atlantic City. He's spending it with, you know, one of his best buddies. He meets up with his friend, played by Gary Sinise.
Character's name is Kevin Dunn, which is weird because the actor Kevin Dunn is in this movie.
Huh.
And apparently, Kevin Dunn is like the only Cage in action. Like, he'll come back in Frozen Ground. He plays the pay-per-view announcer, that guy in a tuxedo.
Okay.
He's been in a million things. I've seen him in all sorts of stuff. He's really the only actor or main person behind the scenes that'll ever come back to Cage Club. But what's kind of weird is that when they got to set originally, supposedly, according to the internet lore, Kevin Dunn, the actor, checked into the hotel and was brought up to the penthouse suite. And then they quickly realized that the penthouse suite was actually for Kevin Dunn, the character, for Cary Sinise. And so Kevin Dunn, the actor, got kicked out and had to go stay at like some like chain hotel nearby. It was confusing, and apparently both Cary Sinise and Kevin Dunn didn't like the name confusion. It's not a name that necessarily means anything, right? Like, it's just kind of like a military-ish style name. It could be anything. And to cast someone in the movie with that same name is, like, weird and coincidental and just sort of unusual.
You know, and especially since I didn't catch his name until well into halfway through the film. I mean, there's another character, a girl in this character. I never caught her name. I just called her Girl in White or Girl in Black. Yeah, you're right. Like, that mix-up is just, like, so unnecessary.
Yeah, I don't really have names for anybody in this movie. I called her Carla Gugino. I called her Redhead in Red Dress. The film is so focused on, like, what's going on that they don't really spend time. Like, they introduce the characters. It's not like in Rumblefish where everybody says Rusty James in every sentence. Like, it's not like you're hit over the head with these character names. There's people in on the con or in on the event that's happening. There's the boxers and there's Cage. And that's sort of it. It doesn't matter who these people are. It just matters what they're doing and who they're aligned with.
Yeah, and I think that's establishing a certain tone. You know, we're going to be watching, at first it's sort of like an assassination thriller, and then it sort of turns into sort of a conspiracy thriller. The audience needs to be left in the dark about certain things. Certain things don't matter as much as other things. They're trying to get a lot of stuff across visually in this film. It never hinders the story to any degree. You know, names are sort of not even necessary to a degree. You have Cage, who's the man in gold. You have Carla Gugino, who's the lady in white. You have Gary Sinise, who's the Navy guy. Very easy to distinguish.
What I love about this movie, what I love about the introduction, is that this is the second movie following Peggy Sue Got Married where we're introduced to Cage on TV.
Oh.
Like, in Peggy Sue, he was the appliance salesman, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like Crazy Eddie. And in this movie, he's Ricky Santoro, and he's just like this personality. Like, they're not filming. He's talking to Kevin Dunn, the actor. They're getting ready for the shot, like the introduction to the boxing match. He just shows up. He's like, hey, am I on TV?
I'm on TV. I'm on TV.
Come on, Rick, for Christ's sake, I'm on in 30 seconds, will you?
I think people would vote for this face, don't you?
Yeah.
See, that's the only way you get anywhere these days. You gotta get your big, fat smile all over the tube. Hi, Rick Santoro. Hello, Richard Santoro. I'm Ricky!
This is where I thought he was a bookie, because he's like, yeah, Kevin Dunn's like, place a bet for me. And he's like, you got it, you know? And I was like, okay. So, like, he's a bookie. You know, a couple feet later, oh, he gets, like, a phone call, and it's, like, his girlfriend. So it's like, okay, there's some more sort of establishing information. And then he goes to place the actual bet with a bookie. So it's like, oh, he's not a bookie. Like, oh, man, is this going to keep happening? And sure enough, it sort of, like, keeps happening. Like, he chases Luis Guzman down. I'm like, is he a drug guy? And then he's like, oh, okay, he's a detective. There's a lot going on here.
Your expectations are also kind of inverted again with his relationships. Like, he gets a call from his girlfriend.
Hey, baby. How are you? I was hoping it'd be you. Yeah? Happy almost birthday. Of course I'm still coming. I'm going to be there when it turns midnight. But yes, I'm bringing something with me. It's a surprise. Well, if I told you then, that's right, baby. No. No way. I'm not going to give you a hint. No. Shameless. Monique, you can't say that on a cell phone. Yummy. All right, I will give you a hint. I know you really want one, and it's going to keep you very, very warm.
but he also gets a call from his wife, and, like, there's all this stuff happening. Like, you learn, okay, so, like, in this 13 minutes, right, like, you find out that he's got a girlfriend, that he has a wife, that he's got a big-time gambling problem, that he is sort of, he knows everybody and is willing to, like, do, you know, little things, like place a bet for Kevin Dunn. You find out that he's a cop, that he's not a fake cop, that he's not some kind of pimp or drug dealer. You know that he grew up in this town. You know that he knows the boxer.
Tyler! Woo! Neptune High, right? Check it out, right here! Go Sea Devils! You and me, Tyler! Yeah! Go Tyler! Go Tyler! Go Tyler! Go! Go Tyler! Go Tyler! Go Tyler! Wow! Lincoln! Tyler! Lincoln! Tyler! Lincoln! Ow!
He's been in this town forever. He knows everybody here. You learn again that he is the smoothest of operators, that he sees that ring girl, right? And he's just like, you should be doing something more with your life. Like, here's my number. Give me a call. You learn that he sort of has, like, he's respected enough to be seated that closely to the Secretary of Defense. You learn that he's, like, super into boxing, super into gambling. The camera's, like, panning and, like, tilting and, like, zooming in and showing all this different stuff. And, like, you're hit with, like, all this stuff. We've talked about it several times, but, like, talk about efficient storytelling. Like, it's almost kind of like an info dump, but it's so much of an info dump that, like, you don't have time to breathe. It's exhilarating.
Yeah, it just feels so natural, and it's, you know, it's in real time, right? Like, everything is coming out in real time, so I think that adds to how natural it comes across. Like, it's not cutting back and forth between two guys at a table telling each other all this stuff about them or something to that degree.
Right.
It's really, really efficient.
What I like about this movie is that it really does a good job of subverting your expectations, not only about Cage, like we were talking about, but, like, what characters are good and what characters are bad. It's a little obvious, you know, especially, like, partway through the movie, that Gary Sinise is kind of the bad guy, but he comes off, he's just this high-ranking Navy official, this beacon of goodness, and he's, like, offering to get Cage a job, because he knows Cage is kind of like a crooked detective. He's like, hey, come down to D.C., I'll get you a job, like, really sort of buddy-buddy with this guy.
There's the man whose life I want!
You're late.
You know me, always upholding justice. Where'd you get in?
Last night, I flew in from Norfolk with Bowen, the secretary.
Hey, is that him?
And tuck in your shirt, I'll introduce you. Jesus, I get your front row seat, you show up looking like Don Ho.
Well, pardon my sample affair, Admiral. Why are you so uptight? It's fight night!
Running security tonight. I got a lot on my mind. Kirkland's high profile. He's all over the news and brings the nutcases out of the woodwork.
Carla Gugino kind of comes off, like, as this sort of shady, like, she looks like sort of like the femme fatale, like she's in on some kind of nefarious scheme. It turns out that she's actually good. Gary Sinise was sort of, you kind of expected him to be bad, but I think the fact that Carla Gugino was actually good was kind of a nice little twist. At least it caught me off guard.
Yeah, this is something else they establish in that opening shot, is that Cage and Gary Sinise grew up together, went to high school together, and they sort of, you know, Gary Sinise went off and joined the Navy and became a high-ranking official, and Nick Cage became, like, a detective in Atlantic City. Gary Sinise, he's an American hero pretty much in this movie, so you wouldn't expect, you know, especially after watching The Rock, I'm not weary of anybody in the military turning against their country by any means. But he's, like, there with the Secretary of Defense and I think the Senator. He's got, like, this entourage and he's there. He says to Cage that he's on duty protecting this guy, right? He's like, I asked for this detail. I told the Secretary of Defense. But, you know, it comes to light that Gary Sinise is not trustworthy at all. And, yeah, Carla Gugino is, I thought she was going to be, like, the assassin at first. And they do a good job of, like, using old, you know, noir sort of imagery to set her up that way too.
We ultimately find out that she's the reason that, like, there's this murder, this assassination plot. Like, she's so good and so good of a person. I mean, not even necessarily, like, it's not like she's really going out of her way. She works at some, like, military government complex, and they're developing some missile defense system, and they're faking the results.
Yeah.
And she finds out that it's not actually as effective as they're saying that it is, and the military sort of opinion, at least, you know, Gary Sinise's military opinion, is that even if it's not working as well as they're saying it's working, it's still going to save lives. And she is of the impression that it shouldn't be rolled out until everything is sort of as good as they say it is. So she shows up, this is all in the opening tracking shot, this the whole 13 minutes to start the movie, she shows up to this boxing match to talk to the Secretary of Defense, give him the documents and say, they're lying to you, here's the actual truth. We don't find out, because this movie is sort of told kind of like in a little Rashomon kind of way. it's not like we think we know all the facts up front. We're intentionally left out of things. We just sort of have the pieces filled in later. So we don't know what she's talking about. We just see her walk up to this guy who's a high-risk target who's supposed to be protected, and then as soon as she's talking to him, the guy gets shot and killed. It seems like she sort of set him up, distracted him, and took him out. It's those noir elements that De Palma uses that sort of subvert our expectations.
Yeah, I think misdirection is like a huge theme of this film too, right? Like it's all about you think you know what you saw, but you didn't really see what was going on sort of behind what you were supposed to be looking
right
at. And, you know, to a degree, I think that's very tricky to do. I think they play with that pretty successfully to this degree. Maybe they do it a little too much. Like they have the girl ringside in the red dress and they're like, look at her, look at her. But then they sort of have Carla Gugino in the white dress and the filmmaker seems to be saying, no, pay attention to her. And they just do that, like, a bunch. Like, this movie is told through a lot of flashbacks, and you get a lot of characters' points of view. So every time you get a flashback, it's almost made to seem like it's the truth you're watching, and that this is, like, the most important information, you know, that the story has to tell you at the time. And a lot of, you know, as the flashbacks go on, they kind of contradict each other, and it causes the main character to question everything that's been going on up to that point. It's interesting he used the point of view in the flashback to put you within that character's head, you know, because
right,
that's just what that character wants you to think. It's a kind of a subtle trick, and it almost harkens back to the opening shot where that tracking shot goes on so long it almost feels like I'm following him through the hallways myself. Like, that's my point of view.
I didn't think of it like that. I do like that interpretation. I just saw it like this is Cage's. I think you could interpret it either way, that it's either you as sort of this third party who's sort of near Cage and just watching him do his thing, but it also works as Cage's point of view, that he has like an idea, like he sees Gary Sinise see this girl in the red dress, sees him go over to her, sees the two of them leave. Then we're watching the fight, and we're sort of seeing just him.
That seem right to you?
Kevin, that is right in so many ways.
No, I mean, who's she with? Not the guy next to her. Beautiful woman alone at a fight?
Sexy lady, what's the problem?
You gotta get out of this town, you know that, don't you?
Would you stop going all Jiminy Cricket on me? You can't help yourself, can you?
Really, I mean, get your butt down to D.C. I call a few guys I know from Annapolis, arrange some interviews, get your GS rating, you're in our program. Bureau of Diplomatic Security pays about double what your salary is here, and the money's clean.
Right? All right, you gotta fix my life later. I got money on this. I wanna stay in a good mood, you know, keep positive, because this is fight night!
Don't make Michael grow up here. This isn't a beach town anymore, it's a sewer.
But it's my sewer, Jiminy, and I love it. I kick around about six square blocks, everybody knows me, I got the whole town wired. Someday if I manage to get my face on TV a few times, maybe I'll run for mayor or something, but that's as far as I wanna go. Because I was made for this sewer, baby, and I am the king!
He sort of like hears a gunshot and looks to his left. The Secretary of Defense is dead. Carla Gugino gets shot in the arm. And it works sort of both ways. And that's kind of cool. In terms of like filling in the blanks later from different people's perspectives, I think that it's cool and it's effective, but like it's sort of frustrating. We learn so little each time. It's like we're making a jigsaw puzzle of like what actually went on here. And like every 10 minutes we just get, or we're given like one more piece. It's a way to sort of extend the tension and extend the drama, but it's kind of frustrating to me, at least, in terms of how slowly it all sort of develops.
I think this is, for me, where De Palma's style sort of becomes a problem to a degree. I think he's too focused on trickery with the camera. It kind of doesn't make the story as smooth as it could possibly be, you know what I'm saying? Like, with these flashbacks, yeah, they could just as easily be conversations, and I think they might even work better that way. But he wants you to know that, you know, multiple things are happening at once and characters are crossing over and they might have just missed some vital information and not even realize. Like, it's all these little split screen camera shots where like two completely different things are happening, and then oh, at the end of the flashback they align or they cross over again. And yeah, I think it just becomes kind of tedious, and it actually, instead of engrossing me more with the style and everything, it's kind of pulling me out.
I completely agree. Like, it feels like at times that De Palma is like too influential on the movie. I mean, you know, as a director, you're able to do whatever you want. It seems like it's too much. Like, there's too many directorial flourishes. Like, there's too many, like, sort of tracking shots. Even outside the opening one, there's a lot of cameras following people. There's the split screen shots. There's all these different things that I just wish that, like, we told sort of a straight story instead of being bounced around. We're essentially being thrown off the trail of what's actually happening, not through, like, the script, but through, like, these directorial flourishes, and it's kind of frustrating in that regard.
Yeah, it's very overindulgent, I would say. I think this is after De Palma did Mission Impossible, which wasn't exactly a movie I would have expected him to make. You know, I didn't really peg him as an action director. He's almost like a student of Hitchcock in a lot of ways. Like, he's very much into suspense and mystery and thrillers and things like that. So I felt maybe this was a way of him to get back to some of that, and he just did a little too much. Some of the shots are beautiful. Like, there's those really deep focus shots where you have someone's eyes, like, right in the foreground on one side of the shot, and then someone way deep in the background in another shot on the other side of the shot. But it does feel like he's sort of compensating and trying to tell people, like, no, look, like, I still got it. You know, I can still pull off all this trickery. In his former movies, it worked really well. It's what he became known for. But you're right, I just feel like it's just overstuffed.
I don't really want to defend this movie too much because I didn't love it. I mean, I love that opening tracking shot, but it sort of falls flat for me. But, like, I guess you could consider all these flourishes and all these crazy things that are doing with the camera, it sort of mirrors Cage's ascension or Cage's sort of development. As soon as the Secretary of Defense gets shot, he, as a cop, sort of, like, takes control of the crime scene, and they lock the arena down. Nobody can get in. Nobody can get out.
Well, what the hell is going on here?
187 with an officer-involved shooting. Secretary Kirkland was shot in the neck. Paramedics just wheeled him out, and that's the perpetrator. Security detail leader took him out during the shooting.
That's right. Commander Kevin Dunn, I'm with DOD.
Who are you?
Atlantic City, major crimes.
I'll take it now.
No bullshit you will. This isn't my blood, all right? It's the secretary's. I was sitting right in front of him. I'm a homicide detective and a material witness. This is mine about six different
AC
ways.
AC cops got no business in the casino. This is strictly DGE and state police.
We're not on the casino floor, Gordo. And this arena ain't the Millennium yet. It's Atlantic City, New Jersey, and that belongs to me. I'm acting case agent until relieved by appropriate federal authority. Now, you want to help? You go tell your men to get all the media out here right now. Unless you want the 9 o'clock news to give the secretary's wife and kids a close-up look at his internal organs. Phil, Jim, make this whole arena a crime scene. Shut it down. Nobody goes in or out until the main investigating party gets here.
You're the ones that told him to seal the doors? He can't hold 14,000 people in these goddamn exit tunnels.
Yes, we did, and yes, we can. Those are 14,000 eyewitnesses! Oh,
excuse me.
We can detain for as long as it takes to get 14,000 addresses and 14,000 phone numbers and take 14,000 pictures, now that I think about it.
And so he starts going around trying to figure out what exactly happened, who the killer was, because after the guy gets killed, you see the camera sort of tilts up and you see Gary Sinise kill the shooter. And Cage is trying to figure out, like, you know, how this happened, who's involved, trying to uncover this conspiracy. And he goes and he finds there's the fight footage. And he finds out that the fight was fixed, and then he goes to talk to the boxer, to Tyler, the guy from his hometown, and he just starts grilling him. He's as confused as we are right now, and we all sort of know that things aren't as they seem. Things aren't clear because the story is sort of muddled, intentionally so, but also because all these directorial things are just sort of, like, distracting us from what actually is happening.
Cage goes into detective mode. He just, like, snaps right into it, like, locks down the crime scene. You know, the state police show up and he really gives them, like, a mouthful. He's like, this isn't a casino yet, it's still my jurisdiction. He even takes Gary Sinise's character, who's sort of, like, has this panic attack because he's like, I left my post, I'm gonna get court-martialed. And Nick Cage is like, no, man, like, if there's one thing I've learned, you just focus on what you did right and just don't even talk about what you did wrong. And he sort of helps him get through, like, this situation. And in retrospect, you realize why he chose this guy to be a patsy for him in a lot of ways. Cage is, you know, super detective. Like, he's really, like, he might seem ostentatious or flamboyant or whatever. Like, you know, he almost has, like, a little Liberace look to him to a degree with the rings and stuff. But the guy is good at his job. He goes up and checks the footage of the fight. It deduces that the boxer threw the fight, so he's got to be in on it. And that's a great scene where he goes up to the boxer's penthouse and starts grilling him.
Come on, I saw you and you saw me. And don't pretend like you don't know who I am, girly man. You want to look like a knockout, but when you heard the gunshots, your eyes were open in half a second. Not your fault. Totally understandable reaction, but it kind of ruined the performance, don't you think?
Look, what the hell do you want from me? The man knocked me out!
I looked at the fight tape, Lincoln! Yeah! It was a phantom punch.
a little bad Hollywood acting, but the athletic commission might find it interesting. And a second after you go down, an assassin fires. Well, that's some coincidence. I guess they don't call you the executioner for nothing. And you signed my kid's autograph!
Like, what's weird about Cage's character is that he is so good at his job, but he says at one point in the movie that all he's doing this for is because he wants to be mayor. I think the problem with his character is that he's too good at his job to have the aspirations and to sort of have the personality and to have the character flaws that he has. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He's too good of a cop that in a normal world, and maybe it's saying, maybe this is a commentary on careers or society or the police force or whatever, but it seems like he's good enough as a cop in terms of investigating, in terms of trying to figure out, piece things together, that he should have been able to ascend the ranks just based on merit alone.
I almost get the sense that he would have excelled in the military more than his buddy did. He's just born to do this kind of thing. But I also feel like he's a celebrity, but he is like a B-list celebrity. Like, I feel like he's comfortable in his little space, right? Like, he's got, like he said, he's got like six city blocks or something that he patrols, and everyone knows him, and he's comfortable with that. And it's like, mayor of Atlantic City, like, that's like enough for him, you know? It's like, and it could happen to you. He's comfortable giving away half of his fortune, right? Like, he's a modest guy, even though he is like very flashy. But it's part of him as a conundrum, you know? The character's out there, but definitely.
As Cage is going around, you know, grilling the boxer, talking about a conspiracy, he pulls Gary Sinise aside and he's like, look, I think we have a conspiracy here. He's like, we got the boxer, we have the shooter, we have the woman in the red. He's like, if we have two more, like, we have a conspiracy. Like, all it takes is five people. And he doesn't realize that he's talking to one of those two more, but it's like at this moment that Gary Sinise is like, oh, like, he even says later, he's like, I had no idea you were going to be able to get this far. Like, I had no idea you were this good of a cop.
Yeah.
And so he starts to tie up loose ends. He like goes to meet up with the woman in red and with this guy who was planted in the crowd to tell the boxer when to take a dive. It's sort of one of those classic scenes in a conspiracy movie, a thriller, whatever, where he just starts tying up a loose ends and he just pulls a bullet in both their backs. Like, there's so much happening here. Like, this is the scene where you realize that he's in on it. Before you even have time to process that, you're like, oh, he's just going to kill. Like, he's ruthless. Like, not only is he corrupt, but he's ruthless.
Yeah, he's the ringleader. Like, that's what I deduced, is that at this point, like, this is his plan. Like, I had always suspected that he was part of the plan, but I didn't expect him to have, like, sort of been the plan, which was just, like, a double shock, you know? Because, like, oh, man, like, what else is going on at this point? Like, and now they are all looking for Carla Gugino, right? Because she can't get out of the casino because it's on lockdown. Everyone's sort of looking for her. Cage is back at the looking at the security monitors or something like that. He's like looking and looking and looking, and then when he finds her, Gary Sinise automatically knows about it because he's sort of patched into the hotel security or whatever it is, and it becomes a chase for her.
Cage is after her because he thinks she's a person of interest, which she is, but she's not involved in the way that he thinks she is. Gary Sinise is in it because she's, like, the whole plan was to not only kill the Secretary of Defense, but also kill her. Like, he's got to tie up sort of two sets of loose ends. He's got to tie up the set of loose ends that knows about the failure of the missile plan, but he's also got to tie up the loose ends that know about this sort of failed assassination plot. And so they're both hunting her. Cage just wants to question her. Sinise wants to kill her. This is sort of baffling. Like, she's, you know, Carla Gugino's always been beautiful. I mean, she goes up to this sort of schlubby guy in the casino, and he's playing slot machines. And she basically just like, hey, I'm pretty warm. Do you have air conditioning in your room? Essentially like, hey, are you in town for the convention? Like, let's get out of here. Let's go do something. And the guy's like, yeah. Wait, like, let me just play these slots a little bit more. Really, dude?
This part is insane. Like, this is where I start having problems with the movie because of Carla Gugino's character. During the shooting and the assassination, her glasses break, and they weren't part of her disguise, like I assumed they were. Like, she
it's
really
so dumb.
Needed these glasses. But they don't set that up. Like, you don't see her blurry vision up until this point now where we need her to not be able to make out faces, right? So she's sort of groping her way for the very first time, mind you. Like, she's already been able to sort of steal a shirt and get changed in the bathroom and, like,
get the blood off of her.
Right, and, like, blend into the crowd and evade other people. And now she, like, can't see 2 feet in front of her. And she's, like, groping around the casino, and she finds, like, this kind of nebbish, schlubby fat guy. And And I'm thinking she just needs his glasses, you know? Like, she's going to grab the glasses off his face so she could see again. She wants to get, I guess, like, somewhere safe so she can make a call or something like that, and she's trying to pick this guy up. Cage and the other guy, like, spot her because they think she's, like, a prostitute. Cage is like, no, no, like, that's the girl that sat next to me, like, and then that's how he finds her.
I was so confused when her blurry vision kicks in, yeah, because they do not set it up at all, and a lot of this movie is kind of first-person shots. Like, whenever they flash to us learning a little bit of more information, it's whatever character is sort of telling that story that we see it from their perspective. Before we know that Gary Sinise is a bad guy, we see him walk over to the woman in red. He's talking to her and the camera's just focusing on her boobs. So there's a lot of first person, so like that's established. But then we cut to Carla Gugino and we go to her first person and we just can't see anything. Yeah. And I was like, what is going on? Like, what is the purpose of this? I don't, like, it doesn't really work. It's just weird. Like, she doesn't necessarily need to be, like, there's no real...
Yeah, she doesn't need to be blind because no one really knows what she looks like. Even Gary Sinise, you know, doesn't exactly know what he's looking for up until that point. It becomes, like, a major part of the next 10 minutes. Like, you know, like, she gets into the same elevator with Gary Sinise, and even though he's 4 feet away, she shouldn't be able to even know he's there because she's that blind. Like, she really, like, that's how blind they try to make her out. Like, she needs Coke glasses to see. Yet, she somehow can sense his evil presence or something, you know? So, like, they want to have it both ways. They want her to be blind, but they also want her to know Gary Sinise is the bad guy following her. So, they're breaking their own rules, like, right away. I don't, that's the reason I have a problem with it.
Like, it never pays off. There's no reason for her to be blind. I mean, she still has to get out of there, right? Like, they could...
Yeah, she never gets glasses for the rest of the movie. Like, as soon as Cage sort of rescues her or, like, gets her in his possession, she doesn't really say, like, you know, I need to go get glasses or anything like that. Like, she has no problem sort of following him around for a few minutes, doing whatever she needs to. Oh, they sit in a stairwell and talk, so I guess she doesn't really need to see much.
And that sitting in the stairwell and talking, like you mentioned to me last night, is a new Cage connection. That's two movies in a row. Staircase conversations. And it's something that's probably happened in other movies that we just haven't noticed, but it's just, it's another little weird Cage, you know, having deep heart to hearts with characters, seeing these women in these time of crises just while sitting on staircases. And so Carla's on the elevator with Gary Sinise, and they get off. Cage is in the other elevator talking to the security guard, trying to figure out where they're going. And there's like a race between Cage and Sinise to get to her room or to get to this guy's room. And Cage wins. And it's sort of funny that he kicks the guy out of his own room. And this is when we find out that Carla Gugino is actually a good guy. And it's like I was saying before, it's sort of like mind-blowing because we just see her on the run. And I guess in terms of narrative, we wouldn't be following this bad guy, but it's still like a cool reversal. She comes clean to Cage, and this is where we learn about the missile plans and about the corruption. And this is where Cage and us sort of get the pieces to this puzzle. They start to fall into place.
Yeah, she lays it on him that she works for the government, this whole missile plan snafu that's going down, and she's like, I saw your buddy Kevin, he's like the trigger man, he's the bag man, he's the guy, like, I saw him. And he's like, no, it can't be, you don't know what you're talking about. And she's like, well, would you let me finish? I love that part where she's like, that's not the whole thing. And yeah, by the end of it, it's like irrefutable. Cage like has to go up against his best friend, and he's got some great moment here where he's like, you know, I didn't want to know this, you know? Like, this is something I don't want to do.
Look, I'm sorry if I...
Who gives a shit if you're sorry?
What are you mad at me for?
Because I didn't have to know! You decided to have this problem, not me! My world would have gone on turning just five, and now either way I look, I have to do something I don't want to do. Do you understand what I'm saying? I do not want to do this!
It's kind of cool because it might not have been done like really well, but like what I like about this moment is we see the Cage's character have his crisis of conscience moment. We find out that, like, at least I did at this moment, was like, oh, that his friend is a bad guy to him now. Like, his friend crossed like a line that Cage wouldn't in his mind because people are dead. So I really like that they tried to sort of do that to his character, where it's like now the audience is going to be more behind him because while he may have come off kind of like a scumbag from time to time, he will do the right thing. He will do his job, even if he just wants to be mayor. He still has like that code to abide by. by. It's almost as like he's thinking back like at all those times in his life, and it's time to set things straight.
Yeah, they really establish, they firmly establish that he's got one rule, basically. He's like, I've never killed a man. He sort of has loose morals everywhere else, but as long as he doesn't kill a guy, he's sort of okay doing whatever. This is when he learns out that even though Gary Sinise is, quote, one of the most honorable dudes he knows, like, he's willing to go above and beyond and sort of reach that level that Cage isn't willing to. It's too much for Cage.
Kevin Dunn. You're positive he's the one you saw with Rabat before the shots were fired? Let me tell you a little something about Kevin Dunn. He is one of the most honorable dudes on the planet. Yeah, I know him, and you could be wrong. Yeah, you could. There were people rushing in front of you, and you were nervous, and you were scared. You could be wrong.
Meanwhile, we cut to Gary Sinise, and like he seems to be like in charge of this, but he's still reporting to higher-ups. And he kind of gets, like, in trouble, right? Like, they're like, what's going on? Why isn't this cleaned up yet? And he's like, oh, there's this cop. Like, don't worry, I'll take care of him. Cleaned up a couple loose ends. Like, everything's going to be fine.
Yeah, he has the conversation with the dad from Home Alone, and there's in the, like, a boardroom, right, with the model of the new casino behind them. It kind of almost looks like they're on a spaceship to a degree. Like, and this is one of those sort of moments where the guy just lays out everything that's happened, right? He goes to Gary Sinise. He's like, you're telling me, like, you know, I signed up for killing the Secretary of Defense so you could get your missile program in and I could get money for my new casino and the boxer could do this, you know? And it's like, in case anyone just got back from the bathroom, here's where we're at in the movie. But I always kind of appreciate scenes like this.
They keep cutting to the TV report, and we find out at this point that the Secretary of Defense did die in the hospital, and we also find out that the missile system production was going to continue, and so you're like, oh no, like Carla Gugino, even though she got this guy killed, she was trying to save all these soldiers' lives, like, it's all sort of for naught at this point. Cage kind of, like, comes to grips with his betrayal, like, everything's kind of crumbling around him. Gary Sinise is this bad guy. Not only is he a bad guy, but it looks like he's going to win. It's kind of a lot to handle. His whole world has been inverted. He was kind of king, right? Like, earlier in the movie, he's like, I am the king, like, these are his six blocks, like, he's sort of in charge of everything. And kind of like Meg Ryan in City of Angels, this is a moment where he's like, I don't have control over anything.
Yeah, I really like him sort of from here on out because it's like new territory for him. He's almost like never done the, you know, like he's never been this valiant before, right? He stashes Carla Gugino somewhere in the construction site.
Just like a little like boxcar size room, and then there's just like the outside wall. Like it's just, I don't know what it is, but he's like, hang out here, like you'll be fine. There's nothing for her to do in there. It's just like out of the way.
He literally just like locks her out of the way so that like no one can get to her, and he's the only one that knows where she is now. And then we get his flashback, which isn't point of view, but he has like this epiphany where he realizes there was like a blimp sort of floating around the arena. He comes to see that it had a camera on it, and then he watches that tape, and it's like, you know, this is what his worst fears are confirmed. He literally sees his friend Kevin hand out a bunch of guns to people and like the terrorist and everything like that. And so there's no turning back. He turns around and like Kevin's like there in the room, and Kevin's trying to sort of buy him off, or he's given his whole big speech, like he's given his Ed Harris speech about how the government screwed him, you know, and left him to die, and there is all this, and this is for that. We're getting close to the end here. Friend versus friend officially know what each other are up to.
That's called the first draft of history. It's going to hold.
Why did it have to be me? Why'd you want me next to you?
One, I needed a cop to back up my alibi. Two, I knew you could be bought if anything went wrong. No offense, pal, but I never thought you'd get as far as you did.
You're my best friend. He used me. Made me a sucker. And that hurts me. Because I would have done anything for you.
Then tell me where the girl is.
Kind of like Ed Harris, Gary Sinise's intentions are sort of justified, right? Like, they're not entirely... He's coming from a place that's, like, good. Like, he's trying to save lives. He's trying to avenge the people that he's lost in his life. But the way that he's doing it is not okay. Like,
yeah.
He sort of needs to be like, sit down, like, put in time out, be like, this is bad, don't do this, you're only going to get more people killed, especially, you know, killing the Secretary of Defense, just stop it.
Yeah, like, these guys, like, in this and in The Rock, like, they kind of have an interesting point where they're like, you know, these bureaucrats, they're not out there, they're not soldiers, you know, it used to be a time when they were, and, you know, most of them aren't, and they're elected officials, so they don't really know what it's like, and I get that, but what they don't have sort of the training for is, like, the tact, right? They're military-minded, so at least in movies, the way they're portrayed is, like, all they know is force, you know, so they have, like, this righteous cause, but yet they don't have, like, the means to do it without being seen as a terrorist.
And, like, they don't have tact also in just in terms of, like, negotiating. Like, he offers Cage, like, he keeps, like, it's like he's bidding against himself. He's like,
yeah.
What's it going to take to keep you quiet? Like, $250,000? $350,000? How about $750,000? How about I give you $1,000,000? And Cage isn't saying anything. He's like, I'll give you $1,000,000 to keep it quiet. And, like, you see Cage have, like, this crisis of faith. This will set himself up. You know, he could probably buy a mayorship for that amount, keep his wife happy, keep his son happy, get his girlfriend that really fancy, expensive coat that he was going to get her. But he's like, no, like, I can't do it. Like, you've crossed a line, you've killed a guy. And Gary Sinise pulls a gun on him. And I'm like, oh well, like, so much for friendship. Like, this is it.
Yeah, it's interesting, like, how hard Nicolas Cage has to struggle to turn his friend, you know, to at least even accept the idea that his friend would do something like this. And yet, like, Gary Sinise is just, like, willing to murder his best friend, like, right away. Like, it just tells you so much about the two guys. Just like, oh man, like, how ruthless.
And what's kind of funny, I think, it's sort of like a little bit of a twist. I don't know if it's supposed to be funny. I thought it was funny. The muscle, like, he won't kill Cage because he needs to find out where Carlo Gugino is. And like we've established, Cage is the only person who knows that. So he can't kill Cage yet. So they're going to rough him up a little bit. And what I thought was kind of funny was that it's not just some goon muscle. It's the boxer. And they go, like, back down on, like, underground, and the boxer just, like, beats the shit out of him. I thought it was funny that, you know, it's this trained professional fighter who roughs Cage up instead of just some, like, you know, hired thug. It's this guy's hero, this hometown hero, guy he went to high school with, hitting him with, like, right cross after right cross, bloodying Cage to a pulp.
Yeah, it's funny because I also thought that Tyler was sort of there to save Cage. Like, he overheard everything and he's like, well, what does Tyler think about that? And then Gary Sinise is like, well, he's with me. Like, that's my guy. That's my odd job, basically. Gary Sinise won't even, like, he's killed people, but he won't, like, throw his own punch yet. Like, he ends up punching Nicolas Cage once. It demeans him to show that he needs some other guy to beat his friend up for him. You know what I mean? Like, he won't get those kinds of hands dirty in that way. I don't know. It just made him come across like more of a weasel, you know, at this point. And we finally get to see a boxing match, you know. Like, we really were sort of denied like a look at the match in the beginning. We get a little bit of it during Tyler's flashback in the ring. By the time Nicolas Cage is done getting his ass kicked, I was like, this is probably what he looked like underneath those bandages in Birdie, you know. Like, he needs his whole face like reconstructed.
What's weird is that, like, both boxers that when we finally see them in the ring, they're both kind of, like, dumpy. But, like, one is supposedly the champ, you know, like, maybe the heavyweight champ. So, like, the champ is kind of in good shape. I mean, still not really. Like, he's sort of a big guy. I mean, it's supposed to be a big guy. But his opponent is just, like, a fat guy. There's, like, little details about this movie you're just like, oh, like, that's sort of strange.
I had some notes on the champ's opponent. Like, he was the worst. Like, he was just, like, dancing around the ring, like, waving his arms around, like, barely threw a punch. Like,
taunting like crazy.
Yeah. Like, I couldn't believe that this guy had a title shot.
Cage's sort of final act of defiance in this scene is that Gary Sinise is like, I'm going to give you one more chance, and he just spits on his medals. He just, like, spits this gob of blood onto Gary Sinise's Navy jacket. And so he punches, and he grabs his head, like, sort of slams it down. But he also implants this tracking chip, and sort of like we were talking about, you know, in The Rock with the needle and all these different movies recently, this movie does a really explicit job up front of saying, like, hey, look at this tracking chip. I can see exactly where they're going. And at the end of the movie, he just tacks it onto Nick Cage's back, follows Nick Cage as he's looking for Carlo Gugino, and he's sort of like stumbling through the underground of this arena, casino, hotel, whatever, and the storm is building outside, and like, again, like, this, like, the middle of the movie kind of drags a little bit, but, like, here we're sort of, it's, you know, we have, like, 10 or 15 minutes left in the movie, we have Cage in this huge boxing match, or, you know, Cage getting beat up, sort of staggering to Carlo Gugino, the storm outside's whipping up, and, like, it's kind of getting you excited. There is, like, a return energy here that, as the movie's ending, like, all right, like, something big is going to happen here. Like, we don't know if the good guy's going to win, if the bad guy's going to win, but, like, something's coming, like, real soon.
Yeah, this sort of crescendo is set up really well, cross-cutting between, like, the storm outside getting reported on in sort of, like, a comical manner, but then the really high-stakes situations happening indoors. I'm kind of liking the end here, like, ever since Cage wakes up from having his ass kicked, like, he wakes up and we see, I guess, the mercenaries at this point, right? They could be considered mercenaries. They're sort of putting the dead bodies into something. I wasn't sure what it was at this point. Turns out that they're putting them in cement in the construction site so that they'll be built into the building at some point. And then, yeah, he's just sort of staggering around trying to get back to Carlo Gugino. What I was kind of bummed about was, you're right, they do set up this tracker, but in this movie it's way too obligatory. It's like, hey, check out this tracker, it's going to come in handy later on. And I almost wish, like, you know, we talk about the rule of three a lot, and like, they should have set it up, brought it back, and then had it pay off here at the end at some point. But I completely forgot about it. Like, it wasn't even like, I don't know, it never even crossed my mind until the little blip showed up on his radar screen. I'm like, all right, like, that wasn't hard. He just tracks him to Carlo Gugino. He's just going to murder both of them. If it wasn't for this storm and sort of like a simple twist of fate, he probably would have gotten away from this.
Like you were saying, like, they're reporting on the storm, like, the wind is really blowing up. There's like this globe that was on top of the hotel that blows on the ground. There's like police coming. We're sort of ramping back up into excitement, into like a movie I think is doing a pretty good job. Just like this, in this huge climax, right? Like, Gary Sinise busts in and finds Cage with Carlo Gugino, and then just a police car rolls up and crashes in, and the police are just there to take care of it. Like, it's such, again, like a couple movies recently. Like, it's this Deus Ex Machina where just like Cage is saved by the hand of God, by the hand of fate. It just feels cheap. It's like a cheap save for his character that he didn't, you know, I mean, he's all bloodied and beaten up, but like, it could have been cool if Carla Gugino empowered herself. Like, she's got like a pipe or something in her hand. Like, they could have done something, but no, like, the cops roll up, these cops that we haven't seen all movie, just crash into where they are.
Yeah, I had to rewind this part a couple times just to see exactly what happened. It goes by so fast. It is so, like, what did I just look at? So you have, like, this giant globe rolling down the boardwalk because of the high winds, but then this enormous wave comes crashing over the boardwalk. It hits the news van, and the cop car has to swerve, and it just so happens that, like, the door to the construction zone is like opening because Gary Sinise shot it out, and like Nicolas Cage grabs her, and they have to duck under like the bumper of the car, and it's just like over complex. You're right too in that, you know, Cage needed to like kill his friend even if he didn't want to, or like break his rule, or someone needed to step up. And you're right, it did kind of feel like a cop out here toward the end, no matter how insane of a cop out it was, he tried to make it.
The one sort of nice thing about this final scene is that Cage gets the titular line like a little bit ago. Yeah. When Gary Sinise had Tyler beat him up, he's like, hey, Snake Eyes, you're out of luck. Just, you know, a few minutes later, he gets beat up, he sort of staggers around. He sees that the cops kind of have the drop on Gary Sinise, that he's in like a no-win situation. And he's just like, you got Snake Eyes. Like, he's completely defeated, and he just drops that line. And it's just, it's so corny. It's such like an action cliche to sort of, you know, say the bad guy's catchphrase. But like, I just love it. I mean, like, that's sort of why we're here, you know, for Cage to do that kind of thing.
Ain't no way, Kevin! You got Snake Eyes!
I thought it was great. Like, it was funny. It fit. It was just one of these weird little moments. I almost saw it as like this FU back to his friend, because like, even when Gary Sinise says it, it's almost like, oh, come on, man. Like, you're that kind of bad guy. Like, you've even got like a crappy line up your sleeve when you capture the good guy. Like, come on, dude. So almost at that moment, I was like, the character Nick Cage was playing was sort of like, hey, you've been snake-eyed, like, how, like a taste of your own medicine. Like, how dumb does that line sound, right, when it's said to you?
The action is over. Gary Sinise is he killed or is he just arrested?
They're reporting outside on the boardwalk when the wave crashes into their, you know, news van. The guy, I guess, recovers, and there's someone with a camera there, right? Like, the cops are like, put the gun down. And it's the news guy comes up with the camera, and Gary Sinise sort of like turns and looks at the camera and starts to like walk away. And then he just like takes the gun and shoots himself through the chest.
Oh, he shoots himself?
Yeah, he takes the gun, sort of like puts it. He turns around so like the camera can't see, and he like points the gun at his chest and shoots, and then like the red sort of bleeds through his back.
I thought the cop shot him because they were threatening to shoot him if he didn't put the gun down. It's weird that he shoots himself, but I guess it's sort of finally a little bit of redemption. Like he's a bad guy. Like let him remove himself from the world.
Yeah, I don't know if even De Palma wanted the imagery of like cops shooting some guy in like a Navy uniform, you know, seeing like him getting blown away. So yeah, I think they went the right way here. As long as he's gone.
As long as he's gone. And so the movie is essentially over. Cage gets an award for valor that he saved the day at this arena. Like, it's all sort of told through, like, a press angle. Like, they have a TV ceremony of him getting the award. They have news and anchors showing him with his son. A well-deserved day off to go fishing with his son. And then they cut to the next scene, and he's in this yellow sports car. Sadly, not a red sports car. But they're like, hey, like, what are these allegations of cocaine? He's like, I don't know what you're talking about. And then, like, he goes to jail. Like,
yeah. He's indicted. Like
he's indicted.
It's basically what I saw it as is, you know, since he screwed up the conspiracy, like this big plan, it's like the people in charge that are still around ruined him, you know, like discredited him, ruined his life, and like got back at him for what he did to them. His entire reputation has been destroyed now because of what he did.
So they cut to him on the boardwalk with Carla Gugino. Like, they don't really know anything about each other. And they're talking, and he's like, you know, my girlfriend and my wife both ran away. I guess to give the film the happy ending, he's like, hey, maybe in 12 to 18 months I'll give you a call. She's like, hey, I'd like that. And then they kiss. Like, it's a weird ending.
It does a really hard job to establish that she represents, like, hope and all this kind of stuff, and she's naive but optimistic, and he sort of represents, like, depression and, like, you know, the downside of everything, and like you should be weary and you can't trust anyone. So they're perfect for each other. You know, I say they complement each other so well. Of course they should be together, especially after that pirate story that he tells her.
You know, they say back 200-300 years ago, pirates put phony lighthouses right out by those big rocks, right out there. Ships would set a course by the lights, crash on the rocks, then everybody go out and rob them blind. Only one thing's changed since then. Lights are brighter.
I'm naive.
There's worse things to be.
Some kind of moral there that I couldn't untangle.
At the end of the day, Cage just says, at least I got to be on TV. And then the movie ends. And the movie, like, there's been all these weird endings in Cage Club, and there's another weird ending here where there's just a bunch of construction workers sort of building the new building, right? Like, they're tearing down the old building, building the new one, and they're, like, slowly pushing in on this concrete pillar, and we just see a ruby red ring, and it turns out that is the pillar where the redhead that was in on the plan who was shot by Gary Sinise, like, where she's going to rest for all of eternity. But, like, again, it's weird. Like, it's not really set up well. And you're just sort of like, why? Like, what is going on here? I have to, like, look up why we care. Because there's a bunch of characters basically just doing construction work, and we've never seen any of them before.
This is one of the most perplexing endings to any movie I've ever seen. I mean, they could have just faded to black halfway through this shot and let the credits roll, but they end on the ruby red ring. And yeah, like, it was sort of like this object of distraction throughout the movie to a degree. Like, it belonged to one of the five conspirators, but they show Gary Sinise meet up with her and the other guy, and they're like changing out of their outfits into sort of like army gear or something. Like, he refers to them as soldiers. I just assumed that she took off that ruby ring before she was put into the cement mixer at some point. I don't know, maybe not. And it's like right on the side of the pillar facing out, as if like someone wouldn't see it or take it out of there somehow with a tool or something.
It's real weird, and it's sort of a fitting ending where it's like it's a fitting ending, and like it's a cool idea that just isn't done well. Like, it's close to being cool, but it just not.
Yeah, it's clearly symbolizing something, but again, I don't know at this point what it is. I'm done with it.
I will stick with Lula's ruby red slippers as opposed to this redhead's red ring.
There you go.
So a couple things about this movie. Will Smith was originally offered the role, the Gary Sinise role, but the studio turned down his $12 million demand for this role. You know, pay the guy. Like, he's going to have, like, aside from the fact that just Cage and Will Smith, like, great. He's coming off Independence Day, Men in Black. He's arguably, you know, the biggest star in the world right now. Like, pay the guy $12 million, especially considering the movie came in at $4 million under budget. If you have money to work with, pay the guy.
This would have played so much better if Will Smith was the Gary Sinise role, because there's no way I would have suspected him, you know? Like, he's just, like, I enjoy his acting, and I think especially at this period, he was, like, a lot of fun to watch, and yeah, I just feel like he would have added more dimension to that character.
Apparently, they also offered the role to Al Pacino, and he said no.
What? He seems a little... Well, I guess I'm thinking of Al Pacino now, but maybe he would have worked. I don't know. It just seems like him and Nick Cage wouldn't have grown up together, you know, the characters.
The craziest thing about this movie is that there was a different ending. I don't know if you know about this. Nope. But, like, there's some remnants of it that made its way into the version that we saw. There was originally supposed to be a huge tidal wave that goes through the casino, and they apparently created all the special effects, and it was just cut in post-production. But there's still references to it in the film. Like, there's a shot near the end where the ambulance is driving down the Oceanside Road, and there's a wave about to crash into it. Like, you see this massive wave about to hit the ambulance, and it just cut away. Another thing is, at the very end, Nicolas Cage talks about almost drowning, and there's references to a storm that are made throughout the entire film. It's all supposed to build up to this, like, climactic sort of disastrous ending, and they're just like, nah, we're not going to use it.
That would have been really bizarre if it turned into, like, The Day After Tomorrow for the last 5 minutes, and it just flooded Atlantic City, and it's just, like, an extinction-level event going on there. I have some very loose Cage connections that I picked up on, but, I mean, just bear in mind, they're extremely loose. Nicolas Cage, his son in this movie, his name is Michael. Michael is the name of the dead son in Face Off. His character shoots. So that was kind of interesting. When he's talking to Gary Sinise in the beginning, he says, "You look like Don Ho," to Nick Cage. And Don Ho was mentioned in Honeymoon in Vegas when he's like, "Oh, just tell me, you know, where Don Ho lives. I'm going to Hawaii. He's like, "Oh, no, somewhere near his house." And then finally, Gary Sinise also says, "You know, growing up together, I was always hitting the books and you were always hanging out under the boardwalk." And again, it made me think of Birdie, where he was getting lucky compromising a girl under the boardwalk.
There's no compromising this movie, which is sort of surprising. Considering this movie got an R rating, like, apparently the studio wanted to get it down to a PG-13 and stuck with an R, they don't really make a lot of use of it, right? Like, I guess it's kind of language. I mean, there's not too much violence. There's really, I don't remember any nudity. It's sort of like a really kind of tame R rating, and Cage doesn't get to compromise anybody. So it's sort of a little bit of an unusual Cage Club movie in that regard.
Yeah, you know, watching it, thinking about that now, I could not tell that it was an R-rated movie whatsoever, you know? That's kind of strange that it is. I didn't pick up on any harsh language, really. I mean, the violence isn't very brutal, you know? Maybe it's just for story content, whatever that means. I would say PG-13 on this one.
But it was rated R, and that's just what it went with. It made money. I mean, it only cost about $70 million, and it made over $100 million at the box office, so it was successful, but that's it. That was Snake Eyes. So for all things Cage Club, you can go to cageclub.me. You can read past reviews. You can read the review for Snake Eyes. You can follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe on iTunes. You can rate and review us there. Do all sorts of fun stuff. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And we'll see you next time on Cage Club. Thank you.